Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar, broadcasting from my home studio. Coming up later in the program, dance and music. Can they help in the fight against Alzheimer's disease? But up front, between 2000 and 2019, deaths from heart disease decreased more than 7%, but deaths from Alzheimer's disease increased 145%. More people die from Alzheimer's disease than breast cancer and prostate cancer combined. These numbers may rise as the population ages. Unfortunately, there is no cure for Alzheimer's and treatments have limited effectiveness. But research continues. Alzheimer's and Brain Awareness Month is recognized in June. Joining us on today's program is Clay Jacobs, Executive Director of the Greater Pennsylvania Chapter of the Alzheimer's Association, along with board member Chris Hansen-Kiefer. I want to start with you, Mr. Jacobs. After mentioning heart disease and cancer, I still hear it very often. People say, Alzheimer's disease is the one illness I don't want to face. Do you hear that?
Absolutely, Scott, and it's a pleasure to be with you this morning to be able to talk about these topics. But Alzheimer's disease, it's amazing and bittersweet that it is the case, but in the past years, when we survey communities, actually, Alzheimer's disease and cancer are equal in how concerned people are about getting the disease. And so conversations like this are important. We don't talk often enough, but when we're talking with family or considering ourselves as we get older, it is something we know Pennsylvanians are incredibly worried about for them and for their loved ones.
You know, I hate to rely on an awareness month to discuss something that affects so many families, so many people every single day of the year for years to come in some cases. But because it is awareness month, we'll talk a lot about context and ask some of the basic questions about dementia, Alzheimer's, and brain disease. You know, with Alzheimer's, Clay, it may not be as painful. It may not be as uncomfortable as some of these other illnesses, but it seems as though it's that fear of the unknown, the loss of everything you've loved over the years, and possibly even losing your dignity. That vulnerability is really what frightens people.
Absolutely. When we think of this disease or any dementia, it's that personal, emotional, and physical toll, because with Alzheimer's disease, it is a progressive brain disease, and yet the symptoms we see, the symptoms that concern us, are different than other diseases. They're really changes in people that we love, right? We see changes in personality or memory or how they connect or how it appears they're engaging with the world around them. And so all of those things are much harder to see, right? It's not like seeing a biopsy or seeing a symptom with a treatment or a prognosis. This is something that we see loved ones changing. We try and navigate as best we can, but ultimately we also don't have a cure. And so months like this on something that is can be so devastating, but also so much stigma attached, hopefully opens up the conversation for so many folks who aren't sure what to say.
And by the way, if you have a question or a comment, maybe a story to tell, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we're at smarttalkwitf. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. I want to turn to Chris Hansen-Kiefer for just a moment. Ms. Hansen-Kiefer, unfortunately, you have firsthand experience, like many of us do, with Alzheimer's disease. Tell us about your experience.
Sure. Thanks for inviting me to share my story today. As you mentioned, June is Alzheimer's and Brain Awareness Month, and one of the most powerful ways to raise awareness is to share our stories. So on social media, #EndAlz will provide a lot more stories. I'm one of millions, and so I hope that you will look for those stories. My journey with Alzheimer's started actually when I was a young girl. My mom had an aunt who had Alzheimer's and lived with her family. And I grew up with my mom being very, very afraid of getting the disease. And about 7 years ago, we began noticing changes in my mom. She had trouble making decisions. She's typically a very decisive person and had trouble making decisions about what seemed to be some very simple things, what to make for dinner or which restaurant to go to, those sorts of things. And she began pulling out of things that really gave her joy, one of those being family vacations together. We would often meet in a central place in the United States. We live all over. And I remember getting a phone call on the way to that cabin, and it was my stepfather saying, "We're not going to come." And there was very vague reasons, but we began to wonder what's going on. And a few short weeks after that, my mom went to visit a friend and drove her car just down the block a wee bit to a different house that looked similar, but wasn't her friend's house. And so that so began the journey of us trying to help understand what was going on with her. We had, as you can imagine, different family members have different ideas of how to approach discovery and perhaps diagnosis. And so that took a bit of time to get us on the same page. And I would say we still find challenges in that as we journey along this path. But we did eventually get a diagnosis, and she was in the early stages of Alzheimer's. One of the things that was challenging is that I have three siblings, and we all live in different parts of the United States, and my mom is in South Dakota with my stepfather. And so finding resources was challenging since we didn't live there. And a good friend of mine connected me to the Alzheimer's Association, and that completely changed our trajectory. They provided resources not only for my mom and my stepfather, but for each of us siblings dealing with this in very different ways. We have had a couple family meetings in their office. We have talked with lawyers and doctors that they have recommended. I became motivated to be much more involved in that assistance. So we continue the journey. I'll be traveling out there next month to begin looking at facilities for her with some of my family members, but that's a little bit of what that has looked like for our family.
You use the word journey several times, and very often families that do have a loved one that has been diagnosed use that word. Why do you see it as a journey?
Yeah, I think because it had a beginning that maybe we weren't necessarily expecting, but we entered a path that we didn't know we were going to be on. And things along that path change. There can be very, very sweet moments and very, very troubling moments, much like a journey. Journeys have ups and downs, and it's moving. I don't know what the end will be or how we will, what the journey will look like along the way. But I know that it's ever changing, and we need to adjust and adapt to it continually. So I think journey best fits what I feel we're traveling.
Clay Jacobs, there were a few things that Dr. Hanson Kiefer brought up there that raise questions in people's mind. First of all, when she was talking about her mother thinking about, was it her sister or her aunt? That had Alzheimer's. So many people, when they have a family member, ask themselves, well, is this my fate as well? And, you know, wonder whether there's a genetic component to this. What do the statistics say? What do we know? What does the research say about if a family member has been diagnosed, you know, does have Alzheimer's disease, whether that's something that will run in families?
Yeah, it's a fascinating area, and one where we've learned so much more over recent years, because there's certainly the concern and experiential and anecdotal evidence that would point towards this genetic predisposition. But really what research has shown us is that the specific indications of Alzheimer's disease passing through multiple generations are the outliers, right? They're very specific genetic markers we know that put people at higher risk, often with a younger onset of symptoms and consistent in multiple generations. But for most people, it isn't necessarily that personal connection and that generational concern on Alzheimer's disease. While it may often be what we think of, and our visibility to it means that we see and may second guess, you know, when we have trouble recalling a name or navigating next steps, sometimes that heightens our awareness of it. But ultimately, age is the biggest risk factor still. We know those at over the age of 65 are at higher risk. When we look at over the age of 85, risk increases as well. But it is just one of the risk factors. While it is the greatest, it is that balancing, just like other health issues. Things like diet and exercise and social activity, history of how we've managed blood pressure or diabetes or head injury, all of these things come into play. And that's really why, as you mentioned, research, what we've seen happen in research over the past decade is particularly important because the brain is incredibly complex. Each of us and our lived experience and all of those social determinants of health are different. And so understanding what is truly underlying connected to the disease, what is anecdotal, all of that work has been going on, and quite frankly, it's still actively going on as we learn to better understand the brain, not as a means in and of itself, but ultimately so we can work then towards risk reduction and treatment and ideally a world where prevention is a realistic thing we could be talking about with Alzheimer's disease and all related dementia.
What has research shown over the past decade? What have we learned that we didn't know before?
There is so much, and I would say right now is one of the most exciting times in research in near memory. While I'm not a scientist, certainly we've seen things around risk reduction. We see some of the largest, the U.S. Pointer Study, the largest risk reduction trial ever going on right now. We know the FDA is considering approval of a treatment medication currently. And all of these things and so much more bring us to this point, even as we look at work in care and support and quality care. But ultimately, in research, we have evidence-based practices on the interventions and care and quality support that we know lead to better outcomes for families. We know we can move beyond through whether it's imaging techniques or blood tests or others, our ability to diagnose more accurately and earlier, even just fundamentally. We now know that the disease starts 10 to 20 years before we see symptoms. And so think of how profound that is when for years, research was done on folks with an Alzheimer's disease or likely Alzheimer's disease diagnosis after they received that diagnosis, which could be 2 decades after the underlying changes in the brain started occurring. And so even how we approach it right now, how do we identify early? How do we look at medications and interventions earlier? It's just a fundamental change. To be able to talk about risk reduction, when I started with the association years ago, that wasn't a topic of consideration. But now we know enough to know that in our lifetime and potentially even in the near term, there may be some things we can do that reduce our risk or help people who are in the mild stages or mild cognitive impairment delay the onset of symptoms. And so those types of things have the opportunity to make a difference for millions of people. And that's all built on the science and what we've learned in recent years.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Coming up tomorrow on Smart Talk, questions answered about electric vehicles and also proposed new regulations on fracking. That's coming up on tomorrow's Smart Talk. Today we're talking about Alzheimer's disease, dementia, some other brain illnesses. Our guest today, Clay Jacobs, Executive Director of the Greater Pennsylvania Chapter of the Alzheimer's Association, along with board member Chris Hansen-Kiefer. If you have a question, a comment, maybe a story to tell your own family, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Chris Hansen-Kiefer, I'm curious, Clay Jacobs mentioned that we now know that the brain starts changing maybe 10 to 20 years before some of the symptoms. First of all, you kind of touched on this, but what were some of the symptoms that you noticed in your mother? And I think all families do this. They look back and say, oh, okay, I remember 10 years ago she didn't do this. Maybe that was the first sign. Did you have any of those experiences, or your family have those experiences?
Sure. Yeah. You know, I think, as you mentioned, in the midst of it, I certainly didn't recognize it. But as we look back over the past 10 years, we certainly do. I think some of the earlier ones were that indecisiveness that I mentioned, perhaps a heightened sensitivity. She would be maybe offended or cry a bit more easily than she typically would have. She asked questions often and over again, the same questions. That was actually something that my children, her grandchildren, noticed. You know, grandma keeps asking me ABC, XYZ, and I just answered her about that. So that's can be normal, especially when you're in a big setting and you're talking to a lot of grandkids and people. So none of that really seemed alarming. And until things started adding up. So I mentioned her forgetting where she was parked, or forgetting which house she, not necessarily forgetting she was going to a house, but driving to the wrong house. She actually pulled herself away from the steering wheel when she got very frightened that she couldn't find her way home from a doctor's appointment one day. So those became much more obvious, but I think the indecisiveness, the desire, not the lessened desire to do the things that brought her joy, and sort of being a bit more quiet in hindsight, were probably early signs.
Clay, I said I would ask some basic questions. And again, I can't keep referring to things we've heard from other people. And I've noticed that as I've gotten older and been around people who are getting older, they worry about when they've forgotten something, forgotten a name or directions somewhere, whether it is the start of dementia or the start of Alzheimer's. So with that in mind, what are some of the main symptoms of dementia and Alzheimer's disease?
It's such an important topic, because one of the key things, right, Alzheimer's disease and dementia are not normal aging. By their very definition, there are changes that occur that interfere with our ability to go through daily life. And so often when we think of the early warning signs, it's those types of things that have progressed, gotten worse and more frequent, that interfere with daily life. And so those are things like word finding difficulty, where we're unable to find the word for something, or we switch in other words on meaning and don't realize. We have short-term memory challenges, whether it's in conversations or recall or other things, right? The difference in that example is, for all of us as we age, it may take a little bit longer, but the connection's still there. We can't think of somebody's name, but it comes to us. We misplace items, but we're able to backtrack our steps to get there. And then even as Chris lifted up, we start seeing some of these things like personality changes. And so all of these kind of mix of things we consider warning signs. And often when we talk to communities or people who are concerned, it's, if you're seeing these warning signs, if they're getting a little bit worse, a little bit more frequent, they're happening in multiple areas as well, right? It's not just that, you know, I'm changing a little bit and my interactions may be different, but I'm seeing multiple issues. That's really a point to be talking to your family, potentially talking to your physician, because these are all symptoms, but they could be symptoms of a whole lot of things. And so the ability to have a conversation, to be able to talk through it, and then find out what's going on to our best of our ability is really significant. And often to your question is, when we think of it as just normal aging, or we're concerned but we don't want to talk about it to someone else, that's when we lose valuable time to actually figure out what is going on and be able to plan and have those important conversations.
All right, let's talk a little bit about that, because there are actually people who don't want the diagnosis. I mean, we said in the introduction, there is no cure. The treatments right now have limited effectiveness. Why is a diagnosis important?
So I can certainly speak to that. And I think some of the things that Chris lifted up are just a great example of, at the very base, there's a piece of, if we're diagnosed earlier, what are the things we can do to try and slow progression, right? Whether it's medication, interventions, or others, those are some of the things we do have some visibility to, right? Even things like a study a couple of years ago, the Sprint Mind study that talked about managing blood pressure and its impact on cognition. I mean, there are significant things we can do there, but ultimately, some of the biggest are planning and looking ahead, right? Being able to share your voice and share your story, being able to talk about what you'd want for care or how you'd support, being able to navigate that. Ultimately, I think we referenced earlier this idea of a journey, and it very much is, and we don't know the destination or the pathway, but this idea of being able to have real conversations about what's important to you and those around you, your friends, your family of choice, you get to help map out the path, right? The route you'll take as best possible. And here are the detours we may face, but here's how I'd want to. And so that's not only really important for the individual, but so often when we talk about caregivers or care partners and some of the things that are the most devastating for them is feeling like they're not doing what their loved one would have wanted or not certain about it. And so these things on diagnosis and care planning are just so important. It's why we see both in public policy and private policy so much effort being spent about improving that. It's about building a better path to care to help us navigate the best we can right now.
Let's take a phone call from Ed in Lebanon. Ed, you're on the air. Hello, Ed. Well, I don't know that Ed can hear us, but I do know what his question is. He wanted to ask the difference between dementia and Alzheimer's disease, Clay.
Yeah, so we mentioned the warning signs earlier, and ultimately, dementia is a syndrome. It's we see certain symptoms that have progressed to the point that they interfere with daily life, but it isn't actually the explanation of what's going on or the hallmarks or the underlying the disease. Alzheimer's disease is the most common form of dementia. So it means that someone has dementia, they have some of those symptoms. And then we know there are certain hallmarks, plaques and tangles in the brain with Alzheimer's disease that differentiate it from other forms of dementia. And so dementia is the umbrella term. I almost think of it as you categorize. If we were to say, okay, think about flowers, we'd all have something that pops into mind. We'd think about it. A large group of people may think of Alzheimer's or may think of roses, right, as a type of flower. And Alzheimer's disease is a type of flower. There are other forms of, but it's the one that most people are most familiar with, most likely to think of, and also most prevalent. But things like vascular dementia and a whole slew of other causes are also in play. As we look ahead, the idea of understanding those differences is something that's really important as we look at how do we treat and how do we support people. Because even today, all cancer is not the same. Neither is all dementia.
We have a tweet from Kenan ask, how does a person die from Alzheimer's disease? And Clay, even though you aren't a doctor or a scientist, can you explain when someone, the cause of death is determined to be Alzheimer's, how that happens?
Yeah, and we can certainly speak to that. I think when we think of it from death certificates, you know, it could be anything from failure to thrive or nutrition or pneumonia or all sorts of other diseases. But ultimately what we see is as this disease progresses, it impacts the brain and the brain atrophies. And so the complexity of what our brain does around things we don't even think about, how we, from the day-to-day on how do we brush our teeth, but to the even more innate of how do we fight infection? How do we maintain heartbeat and breathing and other things? How do we make sure that we know we're hungry and thirsty? And so ultimately, if the disease progresses unchecked and there aren't other health issues, the brain changes to a point that how it responds to basic functions is impossible, right? We see things like somebody's unable to feed themselves or take hydration, that they're more prone to infection. And so it's one of the most challenging. It's one of the things that, particularly at the point of diagnosis, we don't often talk about. But ultimately, without health issues, it's that the brain changes so significantly that we're not able to do all of those things. And so the reasoning or what it's identified as may be vastly different, but we know that Alzheimer's disease was a significant contributing cause. And part of when we see some of the things around deaths increasing from Alzheimer's disease and the impact, it's that we've just have a better understanding of how comprehensive its impact is on all sorts of other health issues as it progresses.
Chris Hansen Kiefer, how was your mother diagnosed? What kind of test was she given? Because, you know, this is not something that is diagnosed easily. And I say that in comparison to, you know, cancer or heart disease or lung disease, that the kind of test that the person gets are a little bit different. How was your mother diagnosed?
Yeah, you're right. The diagnosis can be tricky and frustrating for the family. It was a combination of her doctor, her physician, and her psychiatrist, who did a series of cognitive tests with her over a period of time. And then ultimately, they did a brain scan to confirm or rule out technically other things, such as stroke or things like that. So it was a combination of those things. And gathering just observations from the family that they made the diagnosis.
As I said, it's not the easiest diagnosis when compared to diagnosis for other illnesses. There's a lot that goes into it. Clay, you mentioned that one of the things that we're trying to do and that research has shown are ways to slow the progression. How can we do that? What are some of the things that can be done to try to, I don't know whether you can head off dementia, Alzheimer's disease. Can you? But what can you do to slow it down?
So I think if we look at the general population first, one of the things we are seeing is a growing evidence base that you can reduce your risk and see improved cognition. I mentioned earlier the Sprint Mind trial, and that was one where those at risk of high blood pressure had it aggressively monitored, and we saw significant percentages of people who then did not see mild cognitive impairment advance, right? So we show it has a direct causation to, or correlation at least, to whether you'll develop cognitive impairment. And so we look at expanding that, and how do we make sure is that true for all populations and all communities? There's even something right now called the U.S. Pointer Study, which is in different communities throughout all of the U.S. with different diets and exercise patterns and others, and trying to find what the root cause of these protective factors are. Because there's been research that shows that social activity and physical activity, I think even later today you'll talk about dance and activity. We know that mental activity and engaging with others, all of these things show reduced risk. And there's certainly studies that bear that out as an evidence base. But often what we see is that relatable to all? And so the U.S. Pointer Study, as an example, is in out west in California and in the south in North Carolina, in Chicago, in urban, rural, communities of color. It's what are these things that we know are universal for everyone? And can we develop a prescription for the things that reduce risk? And I think one of the important things that all of these studies have shown is that often Alzheimer's disease or even dementia broadly is thought as a issue of aging, right? We think of it in the mid and late stages, but what all of this evidence base and research is showing is it's a lifespan issue. Things as early as secondary education and on-the-job training have an impact on our brain that bears out decades later. And so what are the things we can do with a research base to then advance public health practices and change behavior so people maybe don't get this disease or have reduced severity? And, you know, we have to see what that looks like. But I think it's a testament, even just last year, the Centers for Disease Control found the evidence base strong enough that they've developed a public health center of excellence on risk reduction. That is part of what we see as an important future in the coming years, to not necessarily impact all those diagnosed today, but how do we keep the next generation from getting the disease, and how do we do these things across the lifespan? It is incredibly exciting, and we're just starting to learn more each day.
You know, one of the things that has always struck me about this conversation is that many of the things you just listed, you could be something that you would do with a healthy lifestyle, exercise, diet, but you know, you add some things to it, like brain activity, reading, for example, socializing with people, having healthy relationships with other people. I mean, those just would seem to be the kind of thing that you would do to maintain a healthy lifestyle to begin with.
Absolutely, right? It is somewhat broad, but what's good for the heart is good for the brain, right? They are innately connected and have such an impact on just overall brain health. And so there are topics like neuroplasticity and building cognitive reserve and others, but ultimately it comes down to that. How do we keep our brain as healthy as possible so it can navigate whatever comes and the impact on those outcomes? Well, certainly not. There aren't individuals who have done all of those things that had an impact. That's why we also work towards a cure. But that idea of reducing risk and reducing severity and all of those types of things are there. And if we can incorporate it into a general healthy lifestyle, but with real clarity about what makes an impact, that's big. It's the start of a battle because even now we all know things that are good for our health and how do we align? How do we do those types of things? But it is exciting to be able to talk about that as a very real thing. We could talk about with dementia that 10 years ago, we likely couldn't. And so it's really important work going on and things for people to keep in mind. And I think the piece there is variety matters, right? If we do crossword puzzles every day, we get better at it. But how do we do different things that continuously challenge us? And we see more and more that is key to keeping our brain healthy and hopefully just our whole being holistically being healthy by trying new things and new experiences.
Clay Jacobs is the executive director of the Greater Pennsylvania Chapter of the Alzheimer's Association, along with board member Chris Hansen-Kiefer, who is also a vice provost for student success and engagement and an assistant professor of exercise physiology at Messiah University. Thank both of you for being with us today.
Thank you.
Thank you, Scott.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. In a new book, author Jem Spector writes about the looming threat of neurodegenerative diseases, and that he believes people at risk should develop a plan of action to fight against those incurable disorders. He argues that scientific research reveals how movement, exercise, and dance therapy are helping people in their struggle against brain diseases, and that others can benefit from understanding the medicinal impact of rhythmic movement. Joining us is Dr. Jem Spector. He's author of Movement Plus Music Equal Medicine, Fight Alzheimer's, Dementia, and Parkinson's. And Dr. Spector is also president of the University of Pittsburgh at Johnstown. Dr. Spector, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you, Scott. Pleasure to be with you.
If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. So how did this book come to be?
Well, this book came about because of my, you know, interest in dance and movement, which goes back growing up as a child in Africa, I remember just a lot of music and a lot of dance. And oftentimes you would see ceremonies by medicine men or shamans who would be dancing. And, you know, I forgot all of that. But as I started doing more research, I discovered that even in the United States, what I thought was something that existed in my past, there's still some applications for dance and music in medicine, and that's really how I started looking at it.
So, you know, that's interesting that it was your interest in dance that kind of led to how that could help with maybe some health issues, but one in particular, Alzheimer's disease. But you also talk about dementia and Parkinson's. So how was that line drawn between dance and rhythmic motion to those of brain disorders?
Well, it was quite a surprise because I came across a study in the New England Journal of Medicine where researchers looked at a bunch of lifestyle factors, exercise, people who read a lot, golfed, swimming, and dancing was one of the activities that the researchers looked at. And when they followed the subjects of the research over a long period of time, they discovered that the dancers were less likely to end up with neurodegenerative diseases like Alzheimer's. And that research, or some version of that, has been validated in numerous other studies that movement, when combined with music, has some protective effect on the brain and builds cognitive reserve. There's been research that even shows it increases the size of the hippocampus, the part of the brain that relates to short-term memory. So the research was fascinating, but at the same time, I found it very surprising that while the disease, you know, in many cases cannot be prevented, especially given that there are genetic factors that cause Alzheimer's. And in the advanced stages of the disease, there's really not much that one could say that can ameliorate the disease. I mean, when it progresses, it's very cruel. It's very, it's really harmful. But in terms of building that cognitive reserve, in terms of increasing or reducing your chances for brain degeneration, movement in general, exercise, has been shown to have a very positive impact on the health of the brain.
Why music? What's music's role in this? I mean, yes, we have known for a while now that exercise and movement can help to slow down the progression. But what role does music play in it?
Well, movement and music are like twins, and the combination of movement and music, as a Colombian neuroscientist John Krakauer says, creates a pleasure double play in the brain. So that combination lights up the brain. It gets your neurons firing, increases dopamine production. Dopamine is a neurotransmitter, a signaling molecule that is involved in keeping the brain alive and healthy and active and more efficient, and improvement of relaying messages in the brain, etc. So the combination of music and movement then acts in many ways as something that fires up and lights up the brain. And that's the research when folks have been studied, and they do PET scans, they see just a different kind of brain activity when people are engaging with music and movement. And there's many things happening at one time in the brain. The auditory section of the vestibular, the visual, the somatosensory cortex, all of those parts of the brain come into play and really energize the brain.
So I know that we have a lot of people out there saying, oh, I like this. This is something that we can have a good time with. At the same time, helping our health as well. But everyone has their own favorite style of dance. favorite kind of music. Is there one or two of each that the research has found to be most effective?
Well, any movement, any exercise, and for that matter, it doesn't even have to be conventional exercise. Reducing a sedentary lifestyle, being more active would help. But dance in particular, especially, somewhat complex dances or dances that require you to recall a lot of steps, to think about coordination a lot more, to synchronize with a little bit more intentionality. So, for example, the tango. Many studies have looked at the impact of the tango, and it could be the Argentine tango or maybe the tango, the Finnish tango, but most people do the Argentine tango. The tango, because, you know, you have to really, you know, keep eye contact with your partner. You have to sort of recall the steps, and there's a lot of patterns, and it's got a very structured and patterned movement. All of that combines to sort of create a lot of brain activity. And the key is brain activity in multiple regions of the brain. And it's fairly intense. So you're recalling, you're maintaining visual contact, you're coordinating, you're maintaining balance, and all of those things build the brain's cognitive reserve, increase neuroplasticity. But at the same time, you know, country dances, you know, square dances, the polka, if that's what your thing is, or waltz or rock and roll dances, all of dance seems to have this peculiar impact on brain activity, that combination of dance and music, how it gets the brain excited and the neurons firing, and ultimately increasing your synaptic density if you do it over a sustained period of time. So pick your poison, but I would recommend the Argentine tango.
You realize, of course, that there are dance studios across central Pennsylvania right now that are getting phone calls that couples are signing up. So in your book, you talk about having a plan of action. What do you mean by that?
Well, I think it's broadly speaking, since June is Brain Awareness and Brain Health and Alzheimer's Awareness Month, is to think about how to build that cognitive reserve, how to, you know, among other lifestyle factors. I mean, movement and music are just one of them, but a combination of things, you know, are reducing intake of alcohol, avoiding smoking, getting good sleep, which is hard for a lot of us as we're multitasking, but, you know, improving your sleep, dealing with other risk factors like if you suffer from depression or clinical depression, to get treatment, because there's a connection between clinical depression, especially late in life, and development of neurodegenerative diseases, but also other things like weight control, reducing of these risks for factors for obesity or metabolic syndrome. So the music and dance and physical activity as part of that plan to remain active, to be intentional about your brain health, to not assume that the brain that you had that was very vital in your 20s and 30s would remain the same. I mean, we strengthen our muscles and make sure that we're physically strong by, you know, paying attention to physical activity. The brain requires that we tend to its health, that we nourish it, that we cherish it, to maintain its vitality and to enhance its continued functioning. So the plan of action is really a mix of things. And of course, nutrition and diet as well, to especially in midlife, or especially before you reach midlife, when you're in your 40s and you head to your 50s, to think about these risks and to in effect, do an inventory to say, how active am I? What can I do to enhance my brain health? What are the sets of activities that can help my brain to continue to recall, to good exercise, good critical thinking, good judgment, et cetera. And not to take it for granted. You use it or lose it. You've heard that phrase, right? Use it or lose it.
Yeah.
And that is true. You've got to keep the brain alive with a lot of activity.
And you know, something you just said, not to take it for granted. I think, you know, so many people, as we age, we think about our physical health. You know, you mentioned obesity. You know, we think about our weight. We think about the health of our heart. We think about our muscles and those kind of things. But I don't know if as many people are consciously thinking about their brain health. And that's why what you just said is so important, that, you know, the brain is part of the body and maybe the most important organ in the body. But yet we kind of take it for granted.
Very true. And you said it. It's in many ways really the most important organ. It uses up a lot of the energy consumption of the brain. It's about 30% of your energy consumption is in the brain. And when the brain health goes, everything else begins to go. But at the same time, it's all connected. It's reducing that risk for heart disease and diabetes and hypertension or high blood pressure. That too would help your brain health. So it's physical and mental activity have this curious connection in the brain. And the more physical activity and the more active you are, the healthier your brain tends to be. And again, having said that, there are genetic factors, there are risk factors that physical activity will not modify. And when the disease kicks in, it's very cruel. And we need to pay more attention to research to find a cure. More importantly, to also help the caregivers and who are taking it really, bearing a very heavy toll. And we need to invest in those caregivers and support them.
Is there a deadline? I mean, is there a certain age where, you know, someone would say, well, I'm too old to start dancing or to dance to music? I mean, is there a cutoff point, or is there something you could, if, you know, depending on what age you are, you could start it today?
Well, you could start anytime. In my book, I tell stories about couples or people who started in their 60s and 70s. Even 80s, the key is to remain active. And the big risk factor here, the one thing I want to emphasize, is that we get sedentary and we become more inactive as we get older. The data shows that as we reduce that physical activity, our risk factors goes up. But even if you are at 60 or 70, you could really revitalize your brain and make it a little bit more youthful or younger. And more importantly, you could delay the onset of these dementias. There's a Swedish study that showed women who were active throughout their life were able to delay the onset of dementia and Alzheimer's by as much as 10 to 11 years. So ultimately, we may not be able to escape our fate, but there's substantial evidence that we could delay by as much as a decade. And if you don't get it at 80, you get it at 90 or 95, that is a huge benefit. Plus, continuous activity, even when you suffer from some neurodegenerative decline, can enhance your quality of life, keep you more socially engaged, keep you feel more vital and more connected. And that too can reduce depression and other risk factors that ultimately will improve your brain health.
Dr. Jem Spector is author of the book Movement Plus Music Equal Medicine, Fight Alzheimer's, Dementia, and Parkinson's. He's also president of the University of Pittsburgh at Johnstown. Dr. Spector, very interesting. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you so much, and have a great day.
I'm Scott Lamar. Have yourself a good day.
For a deeper look at the changing tide of healthcare, check out WITF's Transforming Health at transforminghealth.org. a partnership of WITF, WellSpan Health, and Capital Blue Cross.